Well, of course, there is a very serious side to our apparent obsession with all things American and British. Since the Trump presidency continues to challenge many political orthodoxies, none more so than the foreign policy of our great and powerful friend. James Curran is Professor of History at the University of Sydney and a long-term watcher of relations between the US and Australia. He's examining Donald Trump's America First strategy for the Lowy Institute. He's our second commentator on Australian attitudes to the US and the UK. And he's been examining how it might challenge notions of American exceptionalism with implications for the international order and, of course, for us. This is in a week when we've heard about the trade war really revving up between China and the US, and that very unfortunate rhetoric I thought coming out of China yesterday, warning that, quotes, the US is opening fire on the world. So is this really a harbinger for something very deep occurring in the psyche of the US? The phrase American exceptionalism, which has underpinned the country's international policies, remember Madeleine Albright's the America, the indispensable nation, it does roll off the tongue, but what does it really mean? Well, James Curran has been thinking hard about this. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
So why do we need to I think your point is, you think it's time to re-examine this idea of exceptionalism in terms of the US view of itself, but also how it influences their relationship with others.
That's right. I think Trump is an exception in post-war American presidents, and that he doesn't use this language of Pax Americana. Now, American exceptionalism is, of course, a very complex idea, but broadly speaking, it's the notion that America has a special providence or a divine mission to redeem the world, the idea that it sees its values as not only unique to itself, but they are in fact universal, and that America's purpose is to spread those values to all humanity. Now, Trump is a reaction against that kind of language. There have been other presidents that haven't talked that kind of rhetoric before, Richard Nixon, and indeed at the start of his presidency, Barack Obama also expressed some doubt about this notion of a special American calling. But Trump eschews that kind of brand of American altruism. In fact, he trashes it. He believes that during the Cold War, and especially in the post-Cold War period, that America took on too much global responsibility, that it sagged beneath the burden of this call to global leadership, and that as a result, the home front began to languish and America was open to ridicule because it failed in many of these grand kind of democracy promotion initiatives.
And just take us back to a little bit of the history of exceptionalism, please, like going right back before World War One. So when did it really start to emerge as an idea that had such power?
One thing to point out in answering that question is to state that it wasn't actually there. Contrary to the popular understanding, American nationalism was not there right from the beginning. It wasn't in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. The Americans were not saying at that time that they were the first to discover those principles, all men being born equal, or the pursuit of life, liberty, and happiness. And they weren't the first to apply them as the basis for their new government. The founding fathers had a cyclical rather than a progressive view of history. You know, they believed that you had to constrain the vices in all forms of government, whether it be monarchy would be threatened by despotism, aristocracy by luxury, democracy by demagoguery. Mm. I mean, it really gets going. I think the national myth, if you like, America's national exceptionalism really gets going after the Civil War. That's when it triumphs over local, state, and sectional loyalties. But it really comes to the fore in the late 19th century when America's economic power and its preparedness to land its footprint abroad starts to give this sense of special mission and special destiny. I mean, I really think Woodrow Wilson is probably the first, most clearest articulation of it. When
He was president during the World War One, wasn't he?
That's
and
right.
Of course, it prompted the League of Nations and so on. So.
Indeed. And I mean, he was the one to say what he was proposing in setting out the 14 points were not just America's principles, they were the principles of forward-looking men and women everywhere. Mm-hmm. Okay, so here you have this fusion. This is the interesting thing about America and, of course, the Soviet Union during the Cold War. They identify their own nationalism with liberal internationalism. The two are mutually reinforcing, right? America's principles are the world's principles. And basically, from the time of the Cold War, you've had most American presidents sign up to that. You know, keeping in mind, of course, that after World War II, America did everything in terms of its foreign policy that it said it would never do. It entered into entangling alliances. It established bases all around the world. It supported corrupt one-party states and authoritarian regimes. But this notion that America was there to redeem humanity has populated the rhetoric of Truman, of Eisenhower, certainly John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, this whole idea that America has a special role in the world.
So, the view was that this very much bolstered the Middle America, that Middle America had a special sense. Like, the view from outside has been that Middle America got a lot out of this. Are you saying that Middle America has lost interest in it, or that it was never, that was an incorrect assumption?
No, I think Middle America were really the kind of the engine room of this exceptionalism. They were the ones who fought the Cold War. They were the ones who supported the war in Vietnam. They are now, however, fatigued and rather sceptical, in fact, downright sceptical, about being sold some of these grander, more ambitious foreign policy messages. So, for example, there's a great deal of resentment, I think, in the American heartland, not only at the fact that they have had to provide the vast bulk of military personnel, and therefore they've suffered the most sacrifice, especially in recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, but also in Vietnam. But now they are reacting against these kinds of narratives coming out of the Washington foreign policy elite. That is, they were told that China would ultimately become democratic, that they would become just like us. They were told at the end of the Cold War that this was the end of history, that this was the triumph of liberal democracy, and that all that remained to be done was to spread democracy and liberty to the poor, benighted lands that didn't have it. I think they are really pushing back now against that kind of grand, altruistic and universalist.
Well, in fact,
language.
You're pretty blunt in your essay that there is a widespread view among foreign policy commentators in the US that the American political elite has lost the ability to sell a global foreign policy to the average voter. Is this as a result of Iraq and Afghanistan?
I think Iraq has certainly poisoned the wellsprings of that more ambitious strain in America's global outlook. That's right. You know, when you think about the original rationale for the Iraq War, that it was to provide a kind of a stable, democratic Iraq as a bulwark against a rising Iran, and that the road to Middle East peace went through Baghdad, when you think about all those kinds of lofty ambitions for that enterprise, and the sacrifice that was borne, as I said, by Middle America in pursuit of that, and it's ended in tears, and it's spawned the whole rise of a new generation of jihad extremists.
Although they have now got something like a democratically elected government.
Sure, but we're still, I think, a long way off being able to look back on that experience of Bush, Blair and Howard as being a strategic success. It still strikes me as strategic failure. But they will not issue entirely this idea that America is special, hence Trump's view that he wants to make America great again.
But you question that.
Right.
You caution our sort of easy understanding of what that means.
Indeed. He wants America basically not only to be respected again, but he wants America to be able to get its own way in the world. And that means, of course, trampling on alliances and throwing a lot of dirt at multilateral institutions. What I think there's going to be, Geraldine, is this disconnect between a deeply ingrained sense that America is special, that it's on an elevated moral plane to other nations. There's going to be an increasing disconnect and gap between that, which is deep in the American DNA, and their limited ability to be able to get their own way in the world, to be able to effect transformational change abroad. I mean, I think that's what Iraq has shattered. Now, if it wasn't shattered by Vietnam, it was certainly, I think, shattered by Iraq, this idea that the United States could, at the point of a gun, establish democratic havens in the Middle East and elsewhere.
Now, of course, some have wondered whether this attacks America's very idea of itself, that it is this, to use the Chifley term, light on a hill, it is this sort of hope of the world. By the sound of you, you're not you don't necessarily think it is doing that. It might be actually reverting to a much more isolationist part of the American temperament.
Well, that's right. I mean, in some ways, I think Trump represents a version of the kind of original American foreign policy tradition, which was based around the Monroe Doctrine, which was America saying we are going to remain aloof from power politics, old world power politics in Europe. I mean, this is what these were the evils which plunged Europe into total war.
And the Puritans tried to get away from.
Well, that's right. And it's also saying that America's role in the world is not to go into other, march their armies into other lands and drop bombs. It's America as a shining beacon, as a model for other societies to follow. But I don't think Trump is motivated by his reading of the Monroe Doctrine. I don't think he's motivated by splendid isolation. I think he is motivated purely by white working class grievance at how wrong this foreign policy project has gone, in his view, in the Cold War and post-war periods. So we might be seeing America will not be become a normal nation. It will not see itself as simply a nation like all other nations in the international system. It may well be beginning a period of what the Financial Times columnist Ed Luce calls exceptional normalisation.
Right. Okay. So what do we do with that? Because, I mean, I want to finish with what this, because central to your argument is, hey, if you're right, all the allies, particularly us, have got to really rethink our position. Well, we've got to think again, haven't we?
Well, I think so. And, I mean, the problem is that Australians are, I think, quite admirably sceptical of this kind of purple prose that often adorns presidential rhetoric. They ask, well, what about trade? What about balances of power? What about oil? Tell us about the real things. What I'm saying here, again, it's nothing new, is that ideas are important and they have consequences. You know, America in the past paid a very high price for a commitment to its national ideals. For nearly 20 years after the communists came to power in China, they forbade travel to the country and trade with the communist regime in China.
In 49.
That's right. Similarly, in the Vietnam War, there is no material interest that could have justified America paying such a price for the expense of so much blood and treasure in Southeast Asia. What I'm saying is they're not prepared, I think, to pay any price and bear any burden as much as they might have been in the past. Now, we, I think, are oblivious, I think, in the upper echelons of government to this kind of ideological crisis. We don't want to see it there. Instead, the Australian government is talking about 100 years of mateship and 100 years more of mateship. And I think we're missing a fundamental point about just how much change has come across Trump's America. It's not all down to Trump. It's been there. It's been sort
festering
of
away.
Festering away for the last two or three presidential terms. But the longer we ignore this significant dent in American self-belief and self-confidence, the greater difficulty we are going to have in understanding the changing dimensions of American power and their ability to act in the world and in particular in our own region.
So you're questioning whether they really will remain an internationalist even in their DNA, in their bones. They surely will, though, have a sense of mateship and camaraderie with us. I'm putting the argument that I'm sure reverberates around a lot of people's minds just because of our history.
Well, I think to some extent that's right. I mean, the mateship language is the kind of relentlessly soothing mood music of diplomacy. But I can assure you that in the past, any sense of solidarity owing to shared sacrifice or brotherhood owing to time spent on the battlefield together has not counted for one jot, for a row of beans, when America has seen its interests, particularly in this part of the world, as being different to Australia's. Mateship gets pretty quickly tossed out the window. So it looks good on the medallions that the Australian Embassy in Washington has struck. It probably tastes good in the special beer that's been made. But I'm not exactly sure that when push comes to shove and you get down to the brass tacks of national interest, that mateship counts for a whole lot.
So you want us to be alert and alarmed by the sound of it?
Well, look, I think so. It's just to be wary of the limits of this kind of language. It's important. But I think going back to your earlier point, you are right. This internationalist outlook has suffered some pretty major setbacks, and Trump, I think, is doing a lot more damage to this idea. That's the real question here. How much more damage can Trump do to that global outlook if he's, you know, for another 2 years or perhaps another six? And the Democrats are not oblivious to this either. They've put their wet fingers to the populist winds. Mm. There's going to be a huge fight in the Democratic Party between the more liberal internationalist wing and the kind of Sanders, Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren wing. So I think we're not going to see this period as an aberration. I think we're stuck with this kind of America for a lot longer yet. But like I said, they will not lose that sense of special American purpose and mission anytime soon either.
James Curran, terrific to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed.
Pleasure.
And James Curran's paper, Americanism, Not Globalism, President Trump and the American Mission, is published by the Lowy Institute.